Hello, hello. Welcome back to the forum where science comes to socialize. I'm Cleo, and I'm joined today by my super special co-host, Aubrey.
Hey guys, Cleo, are you still mad I called you regular a few podcasts ago? I thought we clarified that issue.
And we are joined once again by our super special guest co-host, Samantha Innes, a former senior fellow at the Institute on Science for Global Policy, current medical student at Drexel University College of Medicine, and forum go-to person on all things medical.
Hello!
What on earth are you doing?
Giving a shout out to all my fellow Twin Peaks fans out there. I'm thrilled to be back on the forum with you two and excited to delve into today's topic, zoonotic diseases.
Not so fast. Don't forget, you can communicate with us on Twitter using our handle @ISGPForum or by searching for the hashtag ISGPForum.
And if you're like me and don't have a Twitter, still, you can find us on Facebook if you search ISGP's The Forum. And don't forget to subscribe to ISGP's The Forum on SoundCloud or iTunes for instant downloads of newly released episodes.
We really need to get you on Twitter, Sam. This is really just sad at this point.
I
Today's podcast is based on a policy position paper titled One Health Plus: Integrated Control and Elimination of Zoonoses from the ISGP's Conference on Emerging and Persistent Infectious Disease, Focus on Societal and Economic Context. The program was convened by the Institute on Science for Global Policy in partnership with George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia.
The paper was authored by Dr. Jakob Zinsteig, Deputy Head of the Department of Epidemiology and Public Health at the Swiss Tropical and Public Health Institute and University of Basel in Basel, Switzerland. That was a mouthful. It was presented by Dr. Zinsteig and subsequently debated by a number of experts at the conference that Cleo just referenced.
So I think it's well known that you two are animal lovers. I'm pretty sure I've seen photos of Cleo snuggling feral kittens in Indonesia. And Aubrey, weren't you just feeding popcorn to geese and deer a few weeks ago?
Yes, Popcorn Park Zoo. Okay, one of the many highlights of New Jersey is Popcorn Park Zoo in Fork of the River. All right, yes, I was feeding popcorn to deer and geese and horses and pigs and a
All
million
right, all right.
other.
Nothing really beats getting wild cats to follow you back to your hostels in Indonesia, though. Like, that is actually the best.
Well, don't get me wrong, I love animals too. Most of the time, I'm studying for medical school in a big old pile of puppies.
Oh my gosh, your Instagram brings me so much joy for that very reason. I could look at it for literal hours.
Ah, thanks. But, and I hate to be a bummer here, but zoonotic diseases, aka animal transmitted diseases, are incredibly serious and could easily be lurking in those innocent popcorn-loving creatures you just exposed yourself to. Aubrey, remember that time we traveled to Arizona for an ISGP conference and all we wanted to do was meet an armadillo?
Oh my God, yes. Still not sure if they even live there, but it doesn't even matter because I love them and I want one.
Well, good thing we didn't find any because armadillos are reservoirs for leprosy. Thanks, med school, for ruining all my armadillo fantasies.
All right, I refuse to believe that all armadillos have leprosy, although it's true that more than 60% of all human infectious disease and 75% of all newly emerging diseases are of animal origin. I'm still keeping armadillos on my bucket list.
All right, you two have gotten us a bit off track here, so let's get back to what's relevant. Since probably the dawn of civilization, domestic animal populations have grown in parallel with the human population, a phenomenon more recently called the livestock revolution. According to our author, this revolution has improved the livelihoods of hundreds of millions of farmers, like me, but has also increased the susceptibility of human populations to transmission of zoonotic disease due to poor health and safety measures.
The unique way in which Dr. Zinsteig categorized zoonoses was by the level of public awareness they elicited. He claimed that in more affluent countries, the public's attention is attracted to emerging diseases, primarily those which are zoonotic in nature.
Oh, like bovine spongiform encephalitis, better known as mad cow disease, severe acute respiratory syndrome, also known as SARS, highly pathogenic avian influenza, aka that time you made a terrible bird flu pun, and animal-source foodborne pathogens.
Exactly. But according to our author, Much less public attention is directed toward re-emerging zoonoses, such as brucellosis and echinococcosis, diseases which are actually linked to the breakdown of the former Soviet Union. Also in this group are endemic zoonoses with wildlife reservoirs, which are basically diseases that make their home in or on animals that are native to a certain region. Examples of these endemic zoonoses include rabies in North America and bovine tuberculosis in the United Kingdom.
And don't forget leprosy and armadillos.
How could we?
Which, after a quick Google search, apparently live in Florida?
What?
Time to start looking at plane tickets much? In the meantime, a small fraction of the public's attention is given to endemic zoonoses linked to poverty in developing countries. To make matters worse, rapid urbanization in these areas introduces additional factors that increase the risk of zoonoses, such as lack of sanitation and increased exposure to livestock.
For example, due to the rapidly growing demand for meat to feed an even more rapidly growing population, farmers in some countries need to crossbreed wild cattle to increase meat or dairy production. And those wild cattle can house some pretty nasty germs, which cattle farmers haven't been exposed to historically.
Before we move on, though, we should clarify what we mean by the term endemic and how it's different from epidemic specifically. Sam, can you quickly remind everyone of these definitions?
I'd love to. A disease is endemic if it exists permanently in a particular region or population. So think chickenpox in schoolchildren or malaria in Africa. Conversely, a disease is considered epidemic if an outbreak occurs and affects many people at the same time, spreading through a community. So while the two sound pretty similar from an English language point of view, they're actually pretty distinct.
Basically, Dr. Zinstag is claiming that the public gets way more concerned about new diseases and outbreaks, particularly in developed countries, than underlying diseases in either developed or developing countries. This concern, however, does not necessarily reflect the actual burden or cost of disease.
Well, consider recent SARS or highly pathogenic avian influenza outbreaks. They garnered a ton of attention in popular media and the public eye, despite the fact that the actual societal burden of these diseases was comparatively quite small.
Flip the coin, and it turns out that endemic diseases carry both a high cost and a high burden. Even so, public concern is driven by an understandable fear of unknown contagions, which can be escalated by media coverage and can lead to tremendous anxiety.
Sure. I mean, it's like everyone suddenly catching sophomoritis.
Okay, what on earth is that?
Yeah, I've never heard of that one.
It's when you're a sophomore in medical school and you start learning about all these terrible diseases, and suddenly you think you've contracted all of them at once, and panic ensues.
Oh, okay, I get what you mean. It's like when I look up my cold symptoms on WebMD and convince myself I have every obscure form of cancer known to man. Fun fact, my best friend in college had the job of making sure that when I was sick, which was pretty often, that I didn't Google my symptoms. True story.
Exactly. Fear, especially fear of the new or unknown, is a very powerful phenomenon. And that's why much more attention is paid to sudden epidemic outbreaks than ongoing endemic diseases with which people are much more familiar.
But despite that, in less affluent and developing nations, the burden of recurring and endemic zoonoses outweigh those of emerging zoonoses. Yet, recurring and endemic diseases attract much less attention and generate less political engagement. Well, with the exception of HIV and AIDS, of course.
And the debaters widely agreed that more affluent countries focus their attention on emerging zoonotic diseases, even though persistent zoonotic diseases pose significantly greater problems in less wealthy areas, such as those in Africa and Asia. That's why many persistent diseases have been labeled as quote-unquote neglected diseases that continually burden neglected communities. Get it?
Since countries that are unable to carry out early detection and rapid response represent a threat to all other countries, isn't it in the best interest of all countries to contribute to global surveillance and control and to aid these neglected communities when possible?
Well, that's what Dr. Zinstag thought. But our debaters had different opinions entirely. They believed that from a cost-benefit perspective, it's not economically favorable for the United States and Europe to treat and control many endemic diseases outside of their borders.
While it was suggested that improving the ability of less affluent areas to manage endemic diseases can also ensure that they'd be able to address emerging diseases should they appear, many felt that the responsibility for making this happen should not fall on affluent regions. They reasoned that interventions by outside agencies may be viewed as subsidies that could eventually become entitlements.
The debaters did find a compromise, though, right? Self-sustained capacity building, both surveillance and non-surveillance related, in less wealthy countries was urged as a way to improve infectious disease control from within the most affected geographic areas.
But we still haven't addressed the overarching issue of what an international surveillance response system would look like, who would be in charge, how developed countries would afford it, etc.
Yeah, so what's the solution? According to Dr. Zinsteig, it involves improving our One Health capacity. No idea what that is? No worries, that's what we have Sam here for.
According to the website, onehealthinitiative.com, the One Health Initiative is a movement to forge equal and all-inclusive collaborations between physicians, both MDs and DOs, veterinarians, dentists, nurses, and other scientific health and environmentally related groups, including the American Society of Tropical Medicine and Hygiene, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, the United States Department of Agriculture, USDA, and the U.S. National Environmental Health Association, or NEHA. The goal of such collaborations is to accelerate biomedical research discoveries, enhance public health efficacy, expand scientific knowledge, and improve medical education and clinical care.
Very impressive.
So there was agreement among debaters regarding the underlying principles of One Health, specifically that there are definite links between the health of humans, domestic animals, wild animals, and ecosystems. Though such links were deemed vital to the prevention and mitigation of infectious diseases, questions were raised regarding whether the goals of One Health are significantly different from just, you know, multidisciplinary collaboration.
Multidisciplinary collaboration across human, animal, and environmental sectors was viewed as critically important for the effective control of infectious disease. While it was generally agreed that multidisciplinary efforts are made, there were differing opinions regarding the extent to which sectors actually work together and the degree to which further collaboration should be required.
As we've already said, the crossover between human, animal, both domestic and wild, and environmental health frequently impacts the emergence, persistence, and spread of infectious diseases in human populations. But somehow, the different sectors, agencies, or organizations that are responsible for protecting each of these groups in turn remain pretty segregated when it comes to their mission and scope of work.
Human and animal health sectors are separated within both governmental and intergovernmental agencies. Although they do periodically work together, collaborations most commonly occur in times of crisis, specifically crises that impact human health.
Probably unsurprisingly, the protection of human health has been the main priority of the infectious disease control initiatives of national governments. Consequently, unless a specific connection to human health has been demonstrated, animal and environmental health issues have frequently received less attention and fewer resources. Sound familiar? Right, it's the same deal with those persistent endemic diseases we mentioned earlier.
That's kind of tragic, especially since it's been demonstrated that shifting attention towards disease control in animals can improve the human health outlook when it comes to certain zoonotic infectious diseases.
This was illustrated by the case of rabies, where it's been shown that intervening in humans via vaccination is less effective than intervening in the animal reservoir, because when you intervene in humans, animal-to-human transmission is not interrupted. In addition to reducing the prevalence of disease among humans, studies have shown that rabies vaccinations in dog populations, aka animals, are initially more costly, but have a higher long-term return on investment.
So, if you want to stop zoonotic disease, all you have to do is vaccinate your dogs. I know I sure did.
Oh my god.
That's not the point Dr. Zinsteig was trying to make, although we will talk about a bottom-up approach a little bit later. Essentially, the recognition of these links between humans, livestock, companion animals, and wildlife is a necessary requirement for One Health. However, it is not sufficient. The success of a One Health approach depends on whether we can demonstrate added value to the health and well-being of humans and animals, and/or financial savings tied to the strategy.
And speaking of financial savings, Dr. Zinstag actually thought that no new institutions or disciplines were needed to foster a One Health approach. All that's necessary is a better working relationship between existing institutions. Otherwise, I mean, if new institutions were established, the added value would be lost to additional costs.
Currently, fragmentation of responsibilities among the NGOs, national and local governments, public health agencies, and scientists charged with infectious disease control has led to duplication of efforts across human, animal, and environmental sectors. Such duplication has, in turn, given rise to increased costs. It was asserted that fragmentation predominantly occurs when leadership on specific issues hasn't been clearly identified.
And the debaters agreed. They concluded that the One Health approach is a valuable framework for determining where it will be cost-effective to address infectious disease problems across sectors and bolster collaborations across stakeholders that currently function in separate disciplines. Here's where a bottom-up approach within existing intergovernmental agencies, national and local governments, and other relevant groups should be implemented to capitalize on One Health principles.
Additionally, debaters believed it was imperative for human and animal health communities to have sound relationships, specifically before another crisis occurs. This includes making sure that mutual respect and partnerships are already in place.
Sharing data and samples, as well as promoting cost sharing where economical, were suggested as relationship building endeavors. And rewarding cross-sector relationships in ways that are economically and professionally profitable will undoubtedly lead to more of these types of collaborations.
As for what types of data will be shared, currently we know more about factors influencing the emergence and persistence of zoonoses, specifically at the molecular level. Think information such as the virulence of a pathogen or ways in which it harms humans.
Comparatively little is known about critical socioeconomic and ecological determinants of zoonoses, despite the fact that disease transmission is driven, among other factors, by demographic and behavioral changes. And here's where multidisciplinary collaborations come back into play again. They are critical to ensure that societal and economic considerations are appropriately factored into disease prevention and mitigation efforts.
Okay. So we need to reinforce existing multidisciplinary relationships and work on determining the socioeconomic and population level factors leading to zoonoses. But then what? We need someone in charge to do something with all this valuable information.
Right. We need the Trinity.
Harry, Ron, and Hermione?
No.
Alvin, Simon, and Theodore?
No.
Jesse, James, and Meowth?
No.
Oh, I know this. Chloe, Kim, and that third one.
Courtney, but no, no, not that either. The trio I was thinking of was the World Health Organization, WHO, the Food and Agricultural Organization, FAO, and the World Organization of Animal Health, OIE.
Oh,
so much more sense.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, okay, so to improve what we will now call the tripartite's effectiveness, it was asserted that these intergovernmental agencies should be further empowered to look beyond their traditional purviews, particularly within collaborative settings.
In terms of standards, the debaters urged that efforts should be made to improve adherence to the WHO International Health Regulations and to increase adoption of the OIE Tool for the Evaluation of Performance of Veterinary Services.
I'm assuming that since these agencies are already huge international entities, they won't need any additional funding beyond what they already use?
Our debaters thought that the smallest of these agencies, the OIE, may require additional financial support, but it wasn't determined whether this is indeed the case or how much assistance would be required.
You see, decisions related to funding are not generally made on the macro long-term level. Therefore, it's been difficult to take action when not all of the sectors are confident they'll actually see benefits to justify their investments.
What Sam is trying to say is that the timescale for establishing benefits may be longer than their budget cycles, and or another sector may gain disproportionately from the initial investment. If you're familiar with the forum, this might remind you of a climate change action principle, the fact that election cycles are way shorter than the amount of time it'll take to see positive outcomes of climate adaptation spending.
Oh, wow. I see what you're saying there. It's a super similar concept.
Efforts to improve human health are frequently prevented by economic considerations at the individual level, as demonstrated by the ongoing issue of antibiotic resistance, which we talked about on the last episode I was on. While the overuse of antibiotics in animal populations has substantially contributed to antibiotic resistance in humans, livestock farmers had used antibiotics because they improved production.
It was suggested that banning the use of common antibiotics in animals would rectify this problem. However, this proposal was contested by debaters who felt that the livestock community is too politically strong for this to be a realistic option.
Although we should mention that since the debate, a number of companies such as McDonald's, Tyson, Taco Bell, Costco, Pizza Hut, Subway, and others have voluntarily pledged to reduce or eliminate the use of antibiotics in meat production due to public concern.
An excellent example of citizens engaging with science and leading to policy change.
As John Lennon once said, the people have the power. All we have to do is awaken the people.
Which I think is the point of this podcast, to get you all to socialize with science and hopefully one day lead to policy change. But you still need a little more information before you can move forward. Now, Aubrey, where were we?
Well, it was widely acknowledged that funding priorities for the prevention and mitigation of infectious diseases are heavily based on where the greatest return on investment can be achieved. For One Health initiatives to receive a larger portion of the limited resources available, more evidence-based research will be needed to demonstrate the economic value of specific cross-sector collaborations and interventions.
For funding to be justified, it was urged that sensitivity analyses should be conducted to help demonstrate why resources should be targeted to a particular geographic area or disease versus other needs.
Another concern is that there's a lack of understanding regarding intervention effectiveness across all biological, environmental, social, and psychological determinants. Models have been developed that reveal the points of vulnerability where interventions against zoonoses will be most effective, and these can be used in policymaking decisions.
The effectiveness of an intervention, such as a drug or vaccine, is measured by the proportion of humans and/or animal populations covered, cured, or protected, and may be much lower than its actual biological curative or preventative efficacy.
This is because the level of effectiveness is determined by factors including availability, accessibility, and affordability. Control programs need to be accepted in different socio-cultural contexts while ensuring diagnostic accuracy, healthcare provider compliance, and consumer adherence. Otherwise, we could have a drug or vaccine that has an efficacy of 100%, yet a final effectiveness of only 15% at the community level. This means that even if all influencing factors have a relatively high individual performance, interventions may drop below the threshold coverage necessary to interrupt transmission of a zoonotic disease.
Right. So a combination of quantitative and qualitative epidemiological, social, and anthropological studies are needed to identify the best ways to determine intervention effectiveness. Determinants of intervention effectiveness at different scales, ranging from the household to the government level, can then be studied to build a comprehensive and quantifiable One Health effectiveness framework that provides evidence for inspiring policy and practice.
Basically, this will help us quantify our intervention's impact. So can we use the experts that already exist within the tripartite? Or is this another circumstance where we need to redefine informatics and create new experts to help the system along?
There was some discussion as to whether creating One Health courses in veterinary, medical, and public health curricula would help train a younger generation to view infectious disease control more holistically. Since the debate, a number of schools, such as the University of Pennsylvania School of Veterinary Medicine and Tufts University, have begun to offer classes and master's programs that focus on One Health curricula.
Additionally, some concern was expressed that the One Health approach is an advocacy mechanism for veterinarians to improve their social standing and increase their resources. Although many disagreed with this view, it was maintained that the burden falls on One Health supporters to prove the value of their ideals for infectious disease control.
Whew! So, in summary, when assessing the effectiveness of One Health approaches, which aim to foster closer cooperation between human and animal health, it's important to measure their success in saving financial resources and improving human and animal health. Therefore, further research is needed to strengthen this evidence involving social science, economics, and ecology.
Exactly. You can't just do it. You need to prove that what you're doing is working and is worth the effort being put in.
Geez Louise, this is really complicated.
It really is. And my name is Cleo.
Well, final thought, maybe we really should just avoid animals and their diseases. It could save us a lot of time, money, and complex intergovernmental collaborations.
So, if you're in support of this One Health Plus initiative,
or if you think it is a plot by veterinarians to get more funding,
and you want to publicly engage in progressing science policy,
you can tweet us using the handle at ISGPForum and by using the hashtag ISGPForum.
If you'd like to hear more from the Institute on Science for Global Policy's past and future conferences, don't forget to join us on Facebook at facebook.com/ISGPForum.
And if you'd rather just listen to our lovely voices, please subscribe to our podcast, ISGP's The Forum, on SoundCloud or iTunes for instant downloads of our upcoming episodes.
Well, thank you, Sam, once again for the assist.
Thank you both for having me. And thank you all for choosing to socialize with science today. We'll catch you next time right here on The Forum.
The Institute on Science for Global Policy, or ISGP, is a nonprofit organization that convenes international meetings bringing together scientists, policymakers, industry leaders, students, and other stakeholders to discuss pertinent scientific issues facing society. The ISGP has no opinions and does not lobby. Therefore, the preceding podcast reflects the views expressed by the presenters and debaters at our conference. For more information, please visit our website at www.scienceforglobalpolicy.org. Thank you.